Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, we'll meet an 89-year-old Navy veteran who can only be described as a survivor. From a tragic car accident at 15 to the torpedoing of his ship during World War II, when he survived overnight floating in the water.
He got me under the arms and brought me over. I couldn't climb. I was just so tired.
Don't miss this veteran's remarkable story today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9. Brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want our veterans to know how much we appreciate their service and sacrifice. We want to hang on to their stories so they're not lost through the generations. And along the way, we sure are educated and inspired as we listen to these tales of long, long ago. Boy, are we in for a story today. It is a story of perseverance, a story of survival, and a story that had a pretty impressive adventure just in the last few months here. 89-year-old Jonas Hofer of Fresno, California is our guest. Originally not from California, but a much different climate. Yale, South Dakota. How big a hamlet is Yale, South Dakota?
Yale had 10 people, one service station, that's it. It was about 6 miles. Huron was about 22 miles. That was Huron South. That was a pretty big town. But Yale was just a stop on the road. It was a wide spot, yeah.
So you say 10 people. How much of that was your family?
Well, we lived 6 miles out of town, but there were 10 people besides us, yeah. Our grammar school there was 12 people, and 5 of them were our family. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I imagine that was a pretty unique way to grow up. I know you only stayed there till you were 8, but not too many people get that experience in early school where the whole school is in one room, probably.
It was one room, and we had our school on one side of the street, and the Indian school was on the other side. So we would play them in baseball and that there, but they had 60 kids of theirs. Because it was a big reservation, pretty big reservation. But we couldn't go to their school and they couldn't go to ours there. But South Dakota was a unique experience. We would trap for fox and beaver and different things like that and sell them the pelts and that and make a little money that way. And so we had a lot of traps. And then most people don't know, the state of South Dakota paid $2 for every gopher tail that you brought in, figuring that you killed the gopher. Uh-huh. And I brought in 200 one time. We had a bunch of traps and we'd put them in a whole bunch of, and through a year's time, I got about 200 of them, I guess.
You hit it rich in the gopher trade, huh?
My brother once got a silver fox, and for that they paid $20 for that pelt. Otherwise, a beaver pelt was $3. And like I say, gopher tails were 2 cents each. I had these Prince Albert tobacco cans full of them.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun hunting all those animals in South Dakota, but what about the weather? Because here in California, we had a cold spell a couple weeks ago, and people thought the world was coming to an end. I guess that was probably nothing for you.
Well, I never even noticed the cold weather, but it got down one time to 40 below. If there was any wind, you didn't get out in it because you'd get frostbite on your face. But in South Dakota, we had cows, about 12 cows we milked. And so we had a rope from the house to the barn. If there was a whiteout, you went, but you couldn't see nothing. So you would go by the rope to find your way to milk the cows and that. My job was to turn the separator, and that was to separate the cream from the milk, because they would only buy the cream. They wouldn't buy the, and we sold that, and eggs and that, and during the year to help you get by.
And then when you were 8 years old, your family moved to Central California. What was that like for you to go from South Dakota to Dinuba, California?
Well, we had a lot of relatives around Dinuba. And so we had a lot of friends right off the bat, cousins and uncles and aunts and different ones like that. So later on, it was very good because they gave us a lot of work. My mother was a widow. My dad died when he was 48 years old. My youngest sister was 5 months old when my dad died. So my mother raised 9 of us children by herself. And in those days, you didn't have federal assistance. So we had to get jobs, and all of us worked where we were at. And I can remember from the time I was 12 years old, I would work Saturdays and different days for different Japanese watermelon guys raising watermelons and that. And I would give my mother $20 a month. All of us did. They were older than me and that. And that kept us going. We worked packing peaches and whatever, all the work. And because of so many cousins and uncles, we had quite a bit of work. They were good to us. And our church also made, because my mother was a widow, was very good to us.
And I hear you were quite the baseball player as a young man. Is that true?
No, not baseball.
No?
No, I was more into track and like polo balling and that there after I got my back healed up.
Well, I that's what I was getting at. The back injury cut short any hopes of athletics and was pretty severe. Tell us what happened to you. You were 15 at the time?
I was 15 at the time and did one of the silliest things I've ever done. Some friends came and we got off the bus and they came up and said, let's go to the mountains and that day. And I thought, well, I've got my studies all done and that there. Okay, I went. Well, that was a big mistake of my life because I changed it so much. We went up above, I forget, in the mountains toward General Grant, and the driver wasn't watching very carefully. He got off the road, and we went down into a canyon. I was unconscious. The driver was killed. And when I woke up was 6 days later or 7 days later in the Reedley Hospital and found out then that they had the funeral ready for my friend, the driver who was killed. The car is still in the canyon down there. It's so steep and that, yeah.
Wow, we're talking 70 years ago, 70 plus, and it's still down there. And I imagine there was heartbreak just knowing your friend had died, but your injuries were pretty severe too. Tell us the extent of that.
Well, I had a broken back, but my spinal cord was not broken. That was the fortunate thing. And I spent that year then in bed with weights on my legs to keep, my brother put up some gymnastics where I could hang on them and go into the bathroom and that. And then the doctor told my mother to get me some weights, and I built up with the weights. And by the time I was a junior in high school, I was probably as strong as anyone in Dinuba High School. In fact, in track, I got the trophy that year because I had made the most points at the Valley Meet in pole vaulting, discus, and the 220 than all the other guys together. So I did get the trophy that year. So that weights really did build me up, yeah.
But I don't want you to sell this situation short here, because for a while there, you probably weren't sure you were ever going to walk again because you didn't even have feeling in your lower legs.
The first 5 or 6 months, I had no feeling in my legs. So the doctor said to get these weights and build up my shoulders because I'd be in a wheelchair the rest of my life. But then through this hanging on this bar in the room and those exercises, slowly my back straightened out. And about 6 months later, I could feel needles in my toes and that. And they just, the doctors and all them, hip, hip, hooray, because they were so happy. But I had been in traction then already for 6 months, and I was for another 6 months. My sister tutored me, though, that I finished my sophomore year in high school. But I was in there until the next year, and then I went to school in crutches for a while. But pretty soon I could throw them away because of this weights and that and getting stronger and stronger. And I built up that way.
I'm trying to imagine being a teenager and dealing with that, the death of a friend, this injury that you take so long to come back from. What was it you think that helped you believe you could recover and that you would have a life to be excited about?
To tell you straight, was after I was got home from the hospital and I was in bed, our pastor came by. And he says, Jonas, are you going to come back? And I had been baptized in that 2 years before that. And that was great, in the Kings River by Ridley. And that was a high point in my life. But then I got in with the wrong fellows in high school. And I'll tell you that right now, birds of a feather flock together. And I got to be just like them. Now, we weren't into drugs or stuff like that and that, but just I was not living for the church and that. Well, when the pastor came in, he came up to and says, Jonas, aren't you tired of running? And I knew what he was talking about. So I says, yes. He says, well, would you want to come back to the Lord? So he came and prayed with me and that. And now this next thing I haven't told many people, because I know everybody hasn't had an experience like that. But that evening then, I decided I was gonna, from now on, I was gonna live for the Lord, and I was gonna watch my steps and that and go biblical. Well, that night I had a vision or something. The room lit up, and to this day, I don't know if it's an angel in there or the Lord or what, but it was a special. And I never had any, after that, any reservations about serving the Lord. When I was in the Navy then, we started the navigators aboard our ship to Houston and had the Bible verses and Bible study once a week. So when the ship was torpedoed and we were in the water, why, we had guys, sailors, come swim up to us and ask us to pray for them.
Wow.
Yeah, and one fella accepted the Lord right in the water there. So then we got picked up the next day, about 14 or 16 hours later, I forget exactly what. And when we got on the destroyer USS Grayson, and my friend Herman Dwyer, he said, well, let's pray, let's thank the Lord. So we knelt down there, and I was amazed at the sailors all standing around, officers and men with their hats off, quiet as a mouse, while we prayed and thank the Lord for saving us.
Well, and I want to get that whole story. At first, we got to get you aboard the Houston, and I want to dwell a little bit on these high school years, because you talked about being really good at pole vaulting, and maybe folks from outside the Central Valley don't know that the greatest pole vaulter of the 20th century was from this area in Dutch Warmerdam, a little older than you. You were there when he broke the world record?
There when he broke the record. In fact, I performed, but I was in C class. The high school were in the morning, and I was pole vaulting then, but I had to be with the A's, B's, and the other, all the big fellas and that there. And our first height was 11 feet, and I never made the first height there. But I had been over 11 feet in Dinuba already before. In fact, I got first in the valley at Delano about 2 weeks before that.
What was the best height you ever made on the pole vault?
Maybe 11 foot 6 inches. Of course, we had a steel pole.
Not bamboo, huh?
Oh, not bamboo, or these new ones they have now that spring you up over and that. You gain a foot and a half, 2 feet by them. And because of, actually, Dinuba High School didn't have pole vaulters at that time. So we went, the guys that did the pole vault, we went out and bought the pole ourselves. It was an aluminum pole. It was a 12-foot pole. But it was just stiff, no give at all in that.
With regard to Dutch Warmerdam specifically, were you guys in awe of this guy? Because he jumped 15 feet, I believe, something like 100 times before anyone else in the world made 15.
I think that time, if I remember correctly, it was over 15 feet when he made that. Now, he also didn't have these springy types in that. He could have made 2 feet or 3 feet higher because he was good. He was very good. He made over 15 feet, a number of times, and he did that to break the record at that. I think it was, if I remember correctly, it was 15, 7 and 3 quarters that broke the record at the West Coast Relays.
And what year did you graduate from the Emperors there in Dinuba? Was that 42?
42, and then I went to Reedy College, yeah.
But something happened your senior year of high school there in December of 41, December 7th. The Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you found out about that?
Yes, we had been, we went on Saturday, we went up to Wolverton Ski Bowl up in the mountains. They have an ice rink up there. And there were four of us that were ice skating up there. And we had so much fun, we didn't want to leave. All the other people left, and we were still there. And finally, the forest ranger said, you better leave if you want to get down. It's starting to snow. And we went about one block and slid off the road. And we couldn't get the car out that night. So we walked back and told the ranger what had happened. He says, well, we'll get out in the morning. He says, you guys can stay in this place. There was a fire in the center. It was warm. They brought us some sleeping bags and a radio. And in the morning, we had the radio on, and we heard that Pearl Harbor had been. And that was before the president said, this day has been a day in infamy, and it'll never go away. We didn't know how much it would change our life then.
And, you know, that's a question I ask every veteran that I interview, and that's the first time I've heard that kind of story, that you're camped out in the woods because your car was stuck, and that's how you found out. Did you make it to school that Monday?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, we then, on the next day, they brought a tractor there and towed us out, and we got all the hills then. And that's when we heard in the afternoon that Roosevelt has said this is a day in infamy, and we're at war with Japan now.
What did that mean to you?
At the time, I didn't realize that it would change things so much. I knew it was a big difference because of war, you know, now. But I hadn't heard about Japan too much before. I had a lot of Japanese friends and that, so this was really a shocker that they would even bomb Pearl Harbor. But I really didn't think it would do as much as it did. Then that year, I went to Reedy College, and the Navy recruiters and Marine and all Air Force came around and found out if we would join. So I had already had some pilot's lessons and in flying, and so I wanted to be a pilot. So I went to the Navy and I asked to get if I would get into the cadet program. And oh yeah, just science. So I took all the physicals and that, and I passed them all for Marines or whatever, because I was very strong.
Boy, it sure sounds like it. We're overdue for a commercial break, so I have to stop you there, but we're going to pick it up with 89-year-old Jonas Hofer when we come back. As if we haven't heard enough yet, we'll get to the day his ship was torpedoed and how he survived overnight into the next day floating in the water. Hometown Heroes will come right back after this. The average age of the veterans on this program is pretty close to 90, so I've seen firsthand over the years the challenges of aging, and I've realized that everybody approaches them a little differently. For some, a friendly senior living community is the ideal option, but for many of us, there's no place like home. I don't have any ruby slippers for you, but I do have an idea. Call Jason Selsler at 317 Construction, recognized by the National Association of Home Builders as a certified age-in-place specialist. Instead of giving up the comforts of home, why not let 317 Construction make your home more comfortable by making it more accessible? Jason and his crew can widen doorways, install ramps for wheelchairs or scooters, reconfigure your counters for better access, modify your shower for safety, secure grab bars wherever you need them, whatever it takes to allow you and your family to keep making your memories in the place that holds so many of them, your home sweet home. Call 905-8490. That's 559-905-8490. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat.
period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, sharing the hour today with 89-year-old Jonas Hofer of Fresno, California. Originally from South Dakota, he spent most of his life in Dinuba, southeast of Fresno, on the edge of Tulare County. We've already heard about his recovery from a catastrophic car accident at the age of 15, how he went on to be a track and field star for the Emperors of Dinuba High. By the way, I looked up that information on Dutch Warmerdam, and the pole vault record he set in 1942 was indeed 15 feet, 7 3/4 inches. So just in case you're wondering about Mr. Hofer's memory, looks like it's pretty spot on. When we left off, Jonas had met all the military recruiters at Reedley College. He had already spent some time in the cockpit, and he wanted to be a Navy pilot. So what did you do about it?
I joined the Navy right there, but I came home and I fooled my mother because she did not want me to fly. So the Navy had two programs, a C-5, which was a cadet program, and a C-12 was an officer's training program. So I asked the Navy lieutenant that was back the next day after we had signed up, after I'm in the service, can I sign over to any place I want to? Oh, yeah. He says, you're in now, and that you can. So I changed to the V-5. And when I came home, I told my mother, I said, here's a V-12 program. They will give us 3 years of college, and then you'll be an officer in that there. And I can just see the clicking in her head going, 1, 2, 3 years, the war will be over. If he goes 3 years, what they didn't tell us was we were going to get 3 years of college in 2 years. And it would be away in Idaho. So she signed for me because I was only 17. She had a sign. So she signed for me, and then the next day I switched over to the, I went to Idaho. That was 42. And then in 43, they took me in the Navy to Idaho and that. And I was about 2 weeks in the flight program when I played baseball on Sunday and broke my knee. So I washed out of the group and that. And they always said, well, in 3 months' time, you can get back in. But in 3 months' time, I was in the South Pacific aboard this cruiser and that. But because my knee was in a cast there, I couldn't march, so I played with the band. I played trumpet. So I played with the band and that. And they found out that I played trumpet. They sent me to San Diego to bugle school, and I was an instructor in bugle school. And 3 months later, I was on the Houston. I asked for seniority. For a musician, just to play bugle calls is kind of old. So I wanted to get out of there after 3 months. And I did.
2 months later, aboard the Houston, the second Houston, and there's a story there, and we'll get to that. And I know I keep backtracking on you, but I'm interested in one aspect of your story because I think a lot of people today have no idea what it was like. You mentioned that you had a lot of Japanese friends. You mentioned you had worked for Japanese-American farmers. So in the spring of 1942, when Executive Order 9066 happened and they're ordered to go to these internment camps, how did that play out in Dinuba, and how did that impact your world and your understanding?
Well, all my friends went to Arizona and were in the camps there, and that, I thought that was pretty bad because they were just as loyal as I was to the United States and that. But the United States didn't consider that and sent them all there. And a few of them came back very angry. But otherwise, my friends and that, none of them did. They just figured, well, it had to be done and that. And they went away for 3 years. And after the war, they came back and went back to school and college and that. And we remained friends. And I never had it really where I was angry at every Japanese and that. I was at the head, the Tojo and some of them that got them into the war. But otherwise, I always figured, well, they're like I'm doing. They're doing their duty to their country and that. And so I didn't feel bad that their hearts were all bad at us. Now, on the first Houston, I've gotten together with a bunch of them at reunions. And so I know what their stories is. They had a bad time. All of them from the first Houston went into Thailand, the prisoner of war camp. And my good friend Charlie Ross was in there a year and a half, and then they took him out. And he was on the Burma Road working with wheelbarrows. Wheelbarrow was the biggest, and they built the Burma Road and that. And there, when they worked, the Japanese were tough. If you couldn't do the work and that'd shoot you ahead and roll you off the road. They wouldn't even bury you. And he went through that there. But he came out. He had met an officer, Japanese officer from Los Angeles that he went to school with. And this officer and him would get together. And when he was transferred on the Burma Road, this Japanese lieutenant was also. And he would give him a handful of rice every day and sometimes some fish and that was left over in thing. So he got to eat a little better than the other guys. When he got out, he had beautiful teeth, and a lot of them had missing teeth because they just didn't have enough vitamins and that. But he had beautiful teeth. They all wondered about that. When the war was over and they walked out toward Shanghai, and the doctors there, the British doctors, checked them and couldn't figure out, here, all your other sailors and the army guys all have bad teeth and that, and you're the only guy who got these. And he told him he ate this rice every day. And that's what did it. Now, he died last year. He was 95, and I've been at a bunch of reunions with him for the Houston.
Well, and for folks who aren't familiar with the story, why there was a first Houston, a second Houston, and why that name has such a legacy in the Navy. This is a ship that was sunk, and for a long time, America didn't know what had happened to it. Just a portion of the crew survived, and they became prisoners of war.
They called it the Ghost That Died at Sondra Strait. Because there was nothing on that, no prisoners in that, to tell them what had happened in that. And so for 3 years, people didn't know what happened to the first Houston. And that was in 42 when they were sunk. And then the Houston was torpedoed in 44.
Yes, and for the purpose of clarification here, there have actually been four Navy ships named Houston. Well, at least three ships and one boat, as my submarine veteran friends will appreciate. There was a cargo ship named the Houston in World War I. There is a submarine today named the USS Houston. But during World War II, there were two different cruisers named Houston. We'll call them the first Houston and the second Houston. So the first Houston was sunk in the Battle of Sunda Strait, February 28, 1942. 700 men died, a little more than 350 survived, but all of them became prisoners of the Japanese. So there were no survivors to explain to the U.S. Navy what had happened. So at that point, another cruiser was named the Houston in its honor, a sort of memorial to those who had died and the ship that was lost. And this second Houston is the cruiser that you served on, Mr. Hofer.
I think it was going to be the San Jacinto. That was changed to the Houston then, our ship.
And you were part of the original crew on the Houston?
I was, yeah. I was. We did our shakedown from Hawaii to Ulithi Island somewhere, and that was the shakedown cruise and that there. And then we were in, at that time we were losing the war. Japanese were taking island after island. They had taken the Philippines, Guam, Tinian, Saipan. Ulithi had been taken. And a lot of those islands and that, they were stepping. And then all of a sudden, the Coral Sea battle was. Then I was on an aircraft carrier at that time. That was the turning point, as far as I'm concerned, of the war. Because we shot down 278 airplanes that day and lost about 25 of our own.
Well, we'll get to that, but let's talk about your time on the Houston, because it certainly ended in a very interesting manner. But first of all, why don't you tell us what were your duties on that ship?
My duties was working with the navigation department. I was a bugle master, so I had five buglers, but I didn't have to get up early in the morning to do it. The five would do that. And then I was in the navigation branch. There's 13 of us in there, and I would steer the ship 1 hour out of four when I was on duty. So I was a helmsman. Actually, I was at the helms when the first torpedo hit, and the ship just raised out of the water and dropped. And I had a helmet on, and my helmet got jammed down on my head.
Let's set the scene for this. So you're taking your turn at the helm, and you people hear torpedo, they assume that's a submarine, but these were actually planes, torpedo bomber planes that were coming. Did you have any idea they were in the area? This is off Formosa, right?
Yeah, we had 40 of them in the air that time, and in fact, after our ship was torpedoed and I was in the water and the battle was still going, oh no, I was still aboard ship, I counted 13 airplanes burning in the water at one time, and maybe 10 of them were Japanese and maybe three of them were in that there. So it was, if you've ever been in a battle like that, there's smoke and noise, and of course your own ship get hit. It's terrible. You can't, but you do what you have to do. You know, you don't panic. You keep on working at it there, hoping it won't hit you.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine what it was like to be in your shoes, because here, what are you, 19, 20 years old at that point?
I was 18, yeah. I was 18 when I was a survivor. But I remember then we were going, and airplanes were going over the ships and dropping torpedoes, and then a torpedo came toward us, and the captain saw it. So the captain says, right 30 degrees rudder, which is white over. So I spun the wheel over, and it was coming in like this, and we were turning in at it. But we didn't get soon enough. It was too close. This airplane had come over another ship and then was between us, so they couldn't fire at him, about 20 feet off the water. And then we couldn't fire at him, and he dropped the fish, and then he went off, and we shot him down, but it was too late then.
So you turned into the path of the torpedo.
Right, yeah. There had been a typhoon through there 2 days before, so the ship was rolling quite then. So the torpedo broke the ship's keel. In the ship there is a keel that's about 10 feet high, maybe 12 inches of steel, both like an I-beam, goes the whole length of the ship. That was broken. So the ship was like that there. So the captain, we thought the ship was going to break in half. So the captain said to check with all the other officers. An hour later, he says, abandon ship. Well, I was waiting and didn't get off right away. I was me and the other guy, Dwight, who had this navigator's Bible study. We were together waiting, and the guys were jumping off the side, and the boats were all going off and that. When an hour later, the captain, one of the officers told him, maybe we can save the ship. So the captain reversed his abandoned ship. But by that time, we had 1,000 guys leave already. So there was maybe 250, I have a picture of it here.
So it was a pretty skeleton crew on a wounded ship.
The ship, the bottom was, of course, there were probably 40, 50 guys in the engineering were all killed right off bat because they were underwater and that there. And the ship was down so far in the water and that there that we had no food. So the Phoenix, another cruiser came by and gave us sandwiches, and that's what this is. We're eating the first time that day.
So this is a photograph while the Houston is still afloat. It's been torpedoed once, and you're still on board, and you're saying, okay, time to eat lunch.
Yes. And what happened then, a seagoing tug came out and hooked onto us and started pulling us away from Formosa toward Ulithi. And 2 days later, a Betty, a Japanese plane, twin-engine plane, came and followed the oil slick, which is in the water, and then came out on the side and came in, dropped the torpedo. And we had no guns except 20 millimeter that was on the main deck, maybe 20 of those. And those guys opened up, and they got the airplane, but here the fish was down the water. Right? And the second torpedo hit under the hangar deck in back where our two airplanes were, and just broke that all up. Luckily, we had a small fire there, but it did not get into the gasoline. So we were saved that way. But we did have some fires in that aboard ship.
So at this point, you're still thinking that this ship is going to make it. But I know I'm bouncing around on you here. Before you pick it up there, I think a lot of people are saying, man, a teenager at the wheel of a ship in battle with torpedoes coming at you, getting hit by torpedoes, listening to the captain, seeing what's going on. Were you nervous? Were you scared? What in the world does that feel like?
No, you just follow orders because you've been steering the ship otherwise than that there. If he says 30 degrees right rudder, full right rudder, left to that, or come to 278, you'd say 278, you'd come to it and says, sir, we're on 278, tell him that. So you just reported the officer wasn't, he could get, because he could see the torpedoes coming in. And the second one, of course, we knew when this Betty dropped that torpedo, we're going to get hit because it was so close.
Did you actually see it?
We saw the trail in the water, yeah, coming right at us. And, of course, we were dead in the water then. That was the second.
Yeah, you're being pulled along by a tug, going very slow.
And our steering aft, the steering was out, so they manually got it, the rudder straightened out, and that's where it was at. We couldn't, the engineering and that was all underwater. So there, the guys were still in there.
So when you saw that torpedo, the wake in the water coming at you.
I didn't see it, but the officer did. Yeah. The captain saw it, yeah.
Well, maybe it's better you didn't see it.
Probably. Well, I was waiting then, and he says, somebody in there, another officer, said, we're going to catch another torpedo on that there. So we kind of braced ourselves for that one. But the first one, I didn't know. When that ship lifted up and fell like that, I didn't know what happened then.
And where were you when the second one hit?
I was on the bridge. I was on the bridge watching for other airplanes and that there. Reporting them, yeah.
And how long did it take after that hit before you knew this time it was abandoned ship for good?
Oh, I'd say about a half an hour after that, the captain said abandoned ship. But to this day, I don't know when I left the ship.
Well, let's explore that in a moment because it's break time again, and I'm getting the feeling we're going to have to continue this conversation on our next episode because I know how much there is. I know there's a lot to this story. And I'm not sure that we can fit it all in today. Jonas Hofer, 89-year-old survivor of the light cruiser USS Houston, CL-81. He's our guest today, and we'll be right back after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Jonas Hofer, 89 years old, an incredible man with an incredible story. And if you're from the area of Sanger, Reedley, Dinuba in Central California, maybe you bought a typewriter, remember those? Or a musical instrument or religious goods from Mr. Hofer at Dinuba Typewriter and Gospel Supply, a longtime business there that he passed on to his son. There wouldn't be a son. There wouldn't be any kids or any grandkids if Mr. Hofer hadn't survived a tragic car accident nearly 75 years ago. Maybe you heard him say that that car is still at the bottom of a canyon out toward Kings Canyon National Park. And none of those people would be here if he hadn't survived the torpedoing of the second cruiser Houston in the Battle of Formosa in October 1944. He described the jolt he experienced when that first torpedo hit, and then days later when the torpedo bombers came back after the Houston and struck again. At that point, he finally abandoned ship. But before we took that break there, you said you didn't know when exactly you left the ship. That moment is a bit of a blur for you?
I have tried to think of that. I've been asked about it. And I know Dyke and myself got together in the water then. And when I came to in the water, there were about 25 of us in the water and that. And you'll think this is funny, and I think it is too, is that we started singing some hymns. And the hymns I remember we sang, one of them was, "There Shall Be Showers of Blessing." Now, why would you sing a song like that? It just seems crazy to me. Why would you sing there? But I guess because most of the sailors knew that song. We sang that and some other hymns and that there in the water. And then it got dark and we got parted. And pretty soon we weren't close. And Dyke and myself, we tied ourselves together with our belts. And we were in the water. And then the next day, the sun came up. During the night, we saw some ships come close. And we were afraid. And first, they'd go over us, but they didn't. But we were afraid to yell out because we didn't know if they're Japanese or ours. Because there were so many ships in the air, Japanese and that. And we were pretty close to Formosa there, too, you know, 80 miles about that time. They figure that during those 2 days, we were towed about 80 miles on the water.
Couple questions. You said when you came to in the water, and you said you don't remember when you went off the ship. Did you get off the ship under your own power, or were you blown off the ship, or you don't know?
I don't know. I think I got off my own, but I can't remember going over the side of the ship. And then it was after I was in the water, Dyke swam up to me and I recognized him. So we tied ourselves together with our belts and then we wanted to stay together.
And did you have a Mae West or any kind of flotation device?
I had two of them. I had a Mae West and then I had the other one, which is a rubber one that has a little hand. You pull it and it blows up and it goes underneath you. The Mae West, after 3 hours, was worthless. It was taking us down that night. And so we both took our Mae West and just dropped them. They sunk, actually. But these rubber ones we had, those were good. Those stayed. And they, if they went down and had a leak in them, they also had something you could blow them. And that's what kept us up till the next day. Yeah.
How many hours were you in the water?
Between 14 and 16. I don't know exactly when we went in. I know I was picked up at about 10 o'clock next morning. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening, while the sun was going down, when we got that second torpedo. And I just don't know, like I say, I cannot reckon at all of when I went in the water. But I know there, because Dyke swam up, and we swam together and tied ourselves together, and we sang these songs in the water. I know that much. And then during the night, we got parted, you know. In the morning when we got picked up, there was nobody close to us. And the USS Grayson was still in a battle then. The ships were still fighting there again. They'd gotten into battle again. And what they did with our ship, they towed it as bait for the Japanese planes to come out, and then our battleships and those, and our pilots would shoot them down. But they missed this one Betty that came in, saw our oil slick, and came in the side and gave us the next torpedo.
I've talked to a few guys who have had to abandon ship and who have had to survive the water for some time. And in different spots, there were different hazards of the water. What did you see? What did you experience floating in the water? I mean, were there things burning around you? Were there things to hold on to? Did you have to fear sharks at all? What did you have to deal with?
There was a lot of wood and stuff and seats and different things in the water. There was a lot of that stuff in the water, a floating metal and some metal and that there. See, the tornado had went through there about 3 days before that, and so we had white caps go over our heads all the time, and you was wet continually. But the water temperature was 87 degrees. So it was warm when you started out. But by the next day, when it had been in it over 12 hours, I think I was in it, I'd say 14 to 16 hours, somewhere in between. Yeah. I was so weak from being in the water so long, and of course we hadn't eaten in maybe 30 hours, that I couldn't even climb the ropes on the ship. What the Grayson did is they couldn't stop, because then they'd get a torpedo. So they kept going, but they put a boat. And the boat took one circle, picked up eight of us. And then while they were picking us up and we was getting on, a torpedo went under the ship. The sailors said it had been set a little too deep, maybe for a battle wagon or aircraft carrier. So then when we got up, of course, and got on, two sailors came down and got me under the arms and brought me over the, because I couldn't climb. I was just so tired and that. And then Dyke says, well, let's thank the Lord. So we knelt down there and prayed. And there were about 100 sailors around us, plus officers and that. And I can remember when we prayed, they were just all quiet. There was really respect. And I really appreciate that when we, and so after I prayed, I looked up kind of and I saw these guys all standing with their hats over the like that there and looking down that. So we were really respected because we had the Bible classes, I think. I think that's why. I don't think they would have done it otherwise.
And along those lines, maybe some folks aren't familiar with what the navigators were as they were founded during that time period. How extensive was that program on your ship?
Well, the officers and the captain was for ours, for us having those there. Because they figured that the more guys that followed the Bible, the less problems they'd have in shore patrol and stuff like that, which was right, yeah. So we would have every Monday night from 8 till 9 o'clock, we would have Bible studies and verse go over some of the verse memorized the guys were, and find out how they're getting along in their Christian life and that. Of course, we had a lot of booze. You know, the guys called us old preachers and what or not, Bible thumpers, and they had a whole bunch of names. But in the wall, in the water there, they swam up to us and were all very good to us and that. And even aboard ship, like I say, while we prayed there and that there, of course, they realized, well, here these eight guys were just saved out of the water and that there, so they have something to be thankful for. And we were.
For sure you were. I know I would be, and I imagine every single person out there listening right now can identify with what you must have been feeling, or at least imagine what that might have been like. We're getting so close to the end of our time that I'm going to save the rest of this conversation for next time. We'll explore more of that experience of being torpedoed, abandoning ship, the uncertainty of floating in the water overnight, and what it was that helped Mr. Hofer persevere through all of it. He still had another ship to serve on before the war was over, too, and just in the last few months, Mr. Hofer got to experience the National World War II Memorial thanks to Honor Flight. So we'll take some time to discuss that, too, including the special connection he had with his assigned guardian for that trip. If you're a sports fan, it's a name that I think you're going to know. I didn't intend to set you up for a cliffhanger. That's just the way it worked out this time. And as you wait for the rest of the story, make sure you hop on Facebook and type in Hometown Heroes Radio. You can see some terrific photos of Mr. Hofer then and now. And there are photos of all our other guests, of course. It's been an exciting year for Hometown Heroes. I'm thankful we were able to bring the show to new audiences on the Central Coast and in Kern County in 2013. And I'll look forward to the start of another year and all the great memories it'll bring our way, including the rest of Mr. Hofer's story. That's it for now. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.